This is Luke Allison here with the CriticalBench.com weekly muscle building expert interview series. Today I'm here with John Cortese. John, how are you?
Hey, good, Luke. How are you doing?
Doing all right. Appreciate you coming on. Wanted to get into your background a little bit, kind of probe your experiences as an athlete, and then also the idea that you operate your own gym right now.
Basically my main background in athletics lies with football and track. Started playing football and track and field as a sprinter. Started at about 12 or 13 years old. The main reason I excelled at those sports is because, you know, my belief was, from the very beginning that, you know, I could just run fast almost naturally. So it kind of just grew to the point to where I could just almost excel automatically. But I had no really idea of how to play football when I even started, so I had to learn a little bit. But the whole strength and conditioning aspect side of training really was something that I grew to love. And, you know, even at a very young age, I was almost, I hate to use the word obsessed, but that's really what it was. How I could become a better athlete, because I could run fast, but I was always, you know, somewhat of a skinny kid. So I had to, constantly read, research, would ask my strength and conditioning coach in high school questions all the time. I bugged my parents to get us a weight set in the garage. We used a little bit. Finally got access to a weight room in high school, which we had obviously a lot more equipment to use than what I had in my garage. But, that's how that grew. And from there, then I went on to play both sports again in college up until my junior year of college. And then finished up at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo in June of 2010. And I got my bachelor's degree of exercise science from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo in June 2010. And so then I moved back home to my hometown of Napa Valley, California. And again, the whole strength conditioning, it was always something I wanted to be a part of, and not just be in it. I wanted to be a part of it and help grow the industry and help, put myself in it and help better athletes, because, I got to a point to where I knew that, my playing days where I wasn't going to be a pro athlete, and I was a decent athlete, but not good enough to make it, beyond college level. So I knew that what I wanted to do was help athletes become the best athletes, the best that they could be physically and mentally. So I got to work right away after school and didn't waste any time and opened up my warehouse gym in Napa in October of 2010, and it's been going well. We're at the 5-month mark now, and we're up to about 24 kids now, 24 athletes. So
that's exciting, because it seems to be one of the things that people want to do. And if it's not in your area, there's an opportunity to make it happen.
Yeah, it was. There was somewhat of a need for it here in town. It's pretty big sports town. There's been a few kids that have kind of made a name for the town lately. They've gone and they're playing really well in college right now, and a couple of them have gone pro. So it's really exciting for the town, and there's nothing around. So I wanted to, give back a little bit, and I also wanted to help out, and really live the dream and see what I could do and help the kids. So
absolutely. One of the things I really want to talk about today is recovery. And I think you're a good person to ask about the link between recovery and performance.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think that could be, possibly?
I would say, the faster that an athlete can recover from training session, the better that they're going to perform. And it really comes down to a few simple things. Like a younger kid obviously has a much better, their ability to recover is much faster than an advanced athlete, simply because the younger kid or the younger athlete is just simply not as strong. They're not as fast yet. They're not as advanced. So their body is not really stressed as much as an advanced athlete who's running a 4.240 and squatting over 500 pounds. You know what I mean? That's a lot more stressful to the nervous system, the joints. So to recover from some very, very hard training for an advanced athlete, the better you become, the more time that you need to put into recovery. And it's something that not a lot of people are paying attention to, and I think that's a big reason why we're seeing a lot of injuries, especially even at the high school level, and middle school level. You're seeing a lot of kids getting hurt, and it doesn't have to be that way if you just, take care of yourself a little bit. And, I always tell my kids the little things add up, little things add up and they go a long way. So just taking the little tiny steps to make sure that you're not getting hurt, that's going to help prolong your athletic performance and make you a better athlete in the long run.
And I think the key is that those little things add up, because that takes a different level of attention and dedication. If you sort of seek those things out, say you're not getting it at your high school, or didn't get it where you played in college, things like that.
Totally.
One of the techniques I think you're familiar with is going to be self-myofascial release. That's not something people have ever heard of. Hopefully they've heard of it, but what is that? What's a really quick summary?
Yeah, very, very basically, it's a fancy term for, self-myofascial release is it's a fancy term that I wrote on the, I didn't invent it, but it's part of the PDF that I put together, and it's basically self-massage. So what we're trying to do is address any sort of tight areas in the fascia or the muscle tissue. When you're training hard over and over again, the muscles, and the fascia around the muscle get tight, and you're gonna eventually build up adhesions or trigger points in the muscle. So what we need to do is address that by simply either getting massage, which is the ideal situation, getting active release, seeing a chiropractor that can do that, or a very simple way to do that is using a foam roller. And a foam roller is just another way of addressing that, by hopefully, getting rid of those tight spots in the muscle or the trigger points or the adhesions, and that will actually help with mobility and recovery and tissue quality and all that stuff.
And just so people know, that's just the basics. You can get really serious in terms of the implements that you use. I want to go over a couple of those really quick, and maybe you can sort of, jump in where you see fit. But obviously, you have foam rollers. You're going to have different density foam rollers. You're going to have PVC pipe. You're going to have the stick. You're going to have tennis balls and lacrosse balls.
Right.
All that you can use for
mock-up. Oh, yeah. Those are awesome tools. I have all of those at the gym. And I have the kids do really light rolling before they warm up, just to kind of, make sure that they're feeling good. And we don't like to go too deep. If you go too deep during the warm up, it can kind of, you're putting the muscles to sleep almost. It's almost like it gives you like a relaxation effect. So you don't want to go too deep. Really light rolls in the warm up, just to make sure we're trying to check for any extra spots that may be tight before the session, so we can address that in the warm up. So if little Billy has really, really tight hamstrings that day, and we notice that, and while we're rolling, we say, okay, we need to do some extra work for him, do some extra stretches before we start his training session, as opposed to somebody else that may not be as tight in the hamstrings, but they might be tight in their quads. You know what I mean? So, sure. But yeah, definitely, the denser the roller, the more it's gonna, the deeper that it's gonna get. Same with the tennis balls and the cross balls. They can actually focus on the smaller muscle groups, like the rhomboids and the feet and the traps and the lower back and stuff, as the foam roller is usually better for the lower body and the larger muscle groups. So.
Is there a good guideline for people to use for sort of where to start, or is that sort of really personal in terms of what?
Generally when I have my kids roll, or when they start, I usually have them start from the feet up. So we start with most of the time they could use some tennis ball rolling on their feet, mainly focusing on the arches, and just rolling up and down on the tennis ball and putting some pressure on it, almost like you're standing on it, and you just kind of roll back and forth a few times, the fascia under the foot has actually been shown that if you just by simply rolling on a tennis ball for a few minutes, it can actually help loosen up, you know, almost everything in the body. So we start with the feet, and then we work up towards the Achilles tendon and the calf with a roller, and then we just keep going up. So we go Achilles tendon, calf, hamstrings, glutes, piriformis, and then lower back, upper back, thoracic spine. And then, sometimes we'll do upper body depending if it's an upper body day or if they absolutely need it. Then we'll get, like, the upper back and the lats and the pecs and stuff like that. But, if we have some extra time after the workout, we'll focus on – we'll get a little bit more detailed. But usually, yeah, it's a good place to start. It's starting from the feet up, from what I found.
Okay. That sort of makes sense. That's easy to remember.
Yeah.
All right. You mentioned the sort of depth that you're rolling at or the intensity. Is that going to be the main difference between how you use it for recovery versus prehab?
Yeah, definitely. The type of roller and the actual density of the roller itself is going to make a difference. You can also, you can make the actual roller itself a little bit more dense by simply applying more body weight onto it. So most of the time, when we're having the kids roll, they're supporting some of the weight on their hands. But for example, if they're sitting down and they're up and they're rolling their calves, they're back on their hands. So they can actually, put more or less weight on their actual muscle of the rolling itself by simply lowering themselves off their hands a little bit. They can also cross another leg over, to focus on one leg at a time to put a little bit more resistance on that. So the roller can penetrate a little deeper. And then, like you said, also the type and density of rollers too. So the black rollers from Axis are the – yeah, right. The ones that from what I found are the actual, the densest ones out there. The white ones, there's a bunch of those out there. The white rollers, they just look like styrofoam.
Right.
Those don't go very deep from what I've seen. But even the black rollers too, those can, you can just go real light and just kind of just go up and down. If you're focusing on more like in the warm up or like a recovery roll, just go real light rolls up and down a few times. And if you're really trying to get deep and really work on some soft tissue work, then you definitely want to focus on trigger points. So you need to roll up and down on the area that you're working on. And when you find a sore spot or any spot that's kind of painful, we need to stop and hold on that for about 10 seconds. Because what that's doing is basically you're telling that muscle to relax by putting pressure on it. And eventually over time, you keep going over that trigger point and back and forth a few times, and eventually that pain should go away. That's about as simple as I can put it, really. But, yeah, definitely.
I think it makes sense if people are
right.
Sort of not that familiar with it. That's probably a good enough starting point, certainly.
Right.
How do dynamic flexibility, mobility work, and stretching all fit together?
I like to address the mobility aspect of training first, because If you're immobile enough to get in the proper positions, especially for athletes and even just somebody that wants to train and feel better, you have good flexibility for mobile, right? So if you're mobile enough to sit in a full squat with a bar on your back, nobody can argue with me and say that kid's not flexible, because he is. Because if they can sit all the way down with their chest up, their knees out, and their heels are on the ground and their eyes are forward, then they have great ankle flexibility. They have great hip flexibility. They don't have any, their hips are strong. Their groin is pretty flexible. And their chest is not tight, because they can sit their chest up, right? So, that's a pretty good test of flexibility right there, is being able to sit in a deep squat. And, what we like to do in the warm-up, again, is we start light with basic leg swings, arm swings, hip circles. And we like to just get the joints warm first before we get into any stretching, because we need to get some blood. We need to get some blood flow in the muscles first and get some heat going. So the more heat you have generated, the better the stretch and the better range of motion. So definitely mobility, flexibility, they do tie in together. We focus more on static flexibility, post-workout. So trying to increase the range of motion of a static stretch and holding it. That's usually, just me saying this, I like to you know, focus a lot more on that after the workout, even like an hour or two afterwards, just to kind of let them calm down a little bit and let the nervous system and muscles kind of calm down after training. So, you know, they can really, really focus, because relaxation is a big part of getting a good stretch. We don't like to force it and hold. And I don't know if you've ever done a really intense stretch before and like all of a sudden you start to feel like you're like shaking almost, you know what I mean?
Sure.
You start to shake and it hurts. I mean, that's too far. So we just need to find a point to where it's somewhat uncomfortable and hold it, and just generally try to increase that range of motion over time. But I think the dynamic flexibility is huge in increasing mobility and flexibility. You know, range of motion. We're trying to get the joint basically through a full range of motion without, you know, caving over or having improper technique. And I think that goes a long way.
One of the things that came up is I'm not sure the degree to which sort of one, you know, flexibility mobility program is going to work if you're,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you have a different split or you're working body parts or maybe you're not doing full body all the time. What
right.
do you think the need is for having multiple routines or being able to create your own routine?
I think it's, regardless of what splits you're using, regardless if it's, if your goal is bodybuilding or powerlifting or Olympic weightlifting or athletes or whatever your goal is, everybody still needs to work on mobility and they still need flexibility because we're really trying to prevent injury. And I mean, really, it's like if you're so tight that you can't sit in a full squat, the benefits of that exercise, you know, that's going to carry over to every goal you have. You know, I mean, if you're not getting full range of motion on your exercises, you're limiting yourself and you're limiting the potential you can have for strength development, speed development, you know, anything really. So, for example, even if, I mean, my bias is towards training athletes and I train everybody like that pretty much. So, you know, we use either full body splits Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, or we do upper lower. 4 days a week, and even then, we're still doing mobility work every day they come in, regardless if it's an upper body day, or we're still doing lower body, you know, dynamic flexibility because we need it, and the kids need it, and they're sitting most of the day, you know, at school, and I know they're not stretching at home, and even if I tell them to half the time, so we have to do it when they're there with me because I can supervise it, and it can be done. So it takes is like 5 or 10 minutes. It doesn't take a long time, and it can be something as simple as leg swings, hip circles, and a couple of dynamic flexibility drills every day. And there's a ton on the internet that people can look up. All you have to do is just search dynamic flexibility. I think I even linked a video on the PDF. If not, I can send you that link too. I made a video on my YouTube page of a sample warm-up. It's super simple, and it only takes like 5 or 10 minutes, and it makes you feel better. And, you know, most pain that people have is just because, you know, something is just so tight and immobile that a joint is affected. So as soon as that kind of loosens up a little bit, back pain goes away, shoulder pain goes away, stuff like that, you know. So it's very important, and all it takes is 5 or 10 minutes a day.
So basically it's good for you, and you have to do it. You don't really have to.
Yeah, I would say – to a point, most people need it, and then once you get to a certain degree of fairly good mobility and flexibility, then maybe you don't have to focus so much on it, but you still need to at least maintain the quality.
That makes sense. One of the things I was really surprised to see in the PDF that you're talking about, we'll make that available to people, was tempo runs, and talk about sort of where that comes from and how that fits into recovery.
Yeah. Basically, I first heard of these tempo runs when I first started researching into Charlie Francis and his training methods. And Charlie Francis is no longer with us, but Charlie was a great coach, and he's got a lot of influence on how I train my athletes and the way I look at sports performance as a whole. And basically what tempo runs are is they're low-intensity – basically, you can call them like rhythm runs, and they're done in between. They're so low intensity. Like the difference between low intensity and high intensity is simply how much stress is it putting on the nervous system. So, you know, again, for just an example, Monday, Wednesday, Friday split. We're, you know, for example, we're using strength, we're using speed development, so we're lifting weights, we're running sprints, we're throwing tennis balls, we're doing jumps on Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Tuesday and Thursday, we still need to do something, even if it's something as simple as a tempo run. And a tempo run basically is looking at, we're trying to flush the body of excess waste product built up from training. So you train hard, and you're sometimes you're going to be really sore the next day. And movement is always better than doing nothing. It's going to help speed up recovery. And the more basically, so what we're looking at, you know, tempo runs, we're trying to, number one, we're trying to build work capacity. Number two, we're trying to flush the system and get rid of, you know, any excess waste product. Number three, we're trying to speed up recovery. And, you know, I think the work capacity thing is huge, because you can do tempo runs, and the idea behind those is, you know, finding a grass field, ideally, a nice flat grass surface, and getting a, you know, 5 to 10 minute warm-up in, and just going out and doing runs no faster than, like, 65 to 70% effort. And people are like, well, what's 65-70% feel like? I don't know what that is.
Right.
It's hard to really tell, and until you do it. And basically, if you don't have somebody, like, this is the first rule. You always say, okay, if my best 100 meter time is 11.5, then I need to run at 65% effort of that. So you just take your time, and that's a lot of work. And if you don't run the 100 meter or whatever, that's, you know, this doesn't apply to you, but. That would be your guideline. So you would be running your tempo run in like 18 to 19 seconds, which is pretty slow compared to an 11-second run. But that's the whole point: is we're not trying to sprint. We're trying to keep it nice and easy, and it still works because we're taking very short breaks in between runs. And you know, if you don't have 100 meter time, which is totally fine, you can also go out and just the general guideline or rule of thumb is you need to start and finish at the same exact pace. So if you're finishing and you're gassed and you're tired and you're going to be a little tired from these runs, but you should not be building up any lactic acid. That's too fast. You should be able to talk to somebody next to you. I mean, these are pretty comfortable rhythm runs. So it's not like you're going out and killing yourself with these runs. These are more, general fitness and conditioning. And, you know, you can do anywhere from, I mean, I would start with 6 to 8 100-yard rhythm runs. For most people that have never done them before, and you're taking like 30 seconds break in between each one. And these should feel very refreshing. You should feel better after a tempo session than you did before. That's the whole point behind those. Man, you're ready to go on Wednesday, and at least you did something on Tuesday, and that will help speed up your recovery over time. Eventually, you can work up to, you know, 10 to 20 100-yard tempo runs. I mean, I've worked up to 2,200 meters in total volume in a session before, and that's pretty good work capacity for a sprinter. And I mean, even power athletes and speed and power athletes, they need some sort of work capacity. They need, you know, some sort of conditioning to help them tolerate more speed and strength volumes, because if you don't have that general fitness, you're not going to be able to tolerate as much volume. So in the end run, and it's definitely going to help recovery as well, and it just makes you feel better and kind of gets you away from training hard all the time, because you just can't go all out every single day. And, you know, eventually you're going to get burned out. So if you don't pay attention to recovery, and if you try to do 100% every single day, because we just can't do that, you know, so.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I think anyone who's been around long enough has tried to do that 3 or 4 times
yeah.
a week and didn't
yeah.
have a very good next week.
Right.
One of the thoughts that I had just about the tempo runs and things like that, it's like maybe that's not as familiar to people that don't have, you know, that type of athletic background. What's
right.
something similar to where, you know, we're trying to manage, trying to manage DOMS, trying to manage work capacity,
right.
like you were talking about? Is there something else that maybe that's a bit more
oh, yeah.
familiar to people?
Yeah. So, I mean, the cool thing about low intensity, you know, the tempo runs, there's so many different substitutes, especially with, you know, I know, most people don't have the luxury of, I mean, I live in California, so it's like, it's sunny year round almost, you know, so, I mean, I have the luxury of being able to go outside and do tempo runs, but some people don't, and they have to stay indoors because it's so cold, or it's raining, or they have a job, or they just can't, they just don't have the time to go out and find a grass field and warm up and do runs. So there's always another way to get it done. Jumping rope is another great way. And you always want to think with on these low intensity days is you need to do something that's not so stressful in the body. So jump rope is pretty low impact, and it's great for athletes. It's great for anybody, and it's easy to do. You don't need a lot of space, and you can do like timed intervals. You can do like 30 seconds on, 30 off, for 10 to 15 minutes, and you know just keep it low key. All you're trying to do is work up a little sweat, get the heart rate up, get the blood flowing. Really, so. Jump rope, stationary bike. A really good one that Charlie liked actually on a stationary bike was a 45-second sprint, 15-second rest. I think it was for 15 minutes. And I think he'd work up after that. So, that's a pretty tough one. If you're really cranking it on a stationary bike, it can get pretty challenging. And, again, if the lactic acid starts to build up a little bit, you know, tone the resistance down and then shake your legs out a little bit. But the good thing, again, about the resistance bike is it's not going to make you sore because there's no eccentric loading at all. You know, it's all concentric pushing. So it's not going to make you sore from doing that. Another one is, you know, dragging a sled or a tire and keeping it really light, you know, but because we're focusing on recovery. We're not focusing on strength. So just doing four backwards drags for 10 to 15 minutes is another good way to get some recovery in. Body weight circuits is another good one. You know, it's something very simple that I've had some of my kids do that are super sore. I'm like, all right, your legs are sore, you're beat up, you're tired. You still need to move, though. So we're going to do a body weight circuit, 10 squats, 10 push-ups, 10 sit-ups, 10 pull-ups. We'll do that like 4 to 5 times. You know, and again, that's a very general template. People can adjust that more or less as they need to. But, again, we're still looking at some sort of work capacity development. And, you know, another good one, too, is using a medicine ball. And that's really, really, really good for we can still get work capacity training in. We can still get conditioning working without hammering the legs too much, which is awesome. I like that, especially for kids that are hurt. All you need to do is find either a partner or a wall, and then you can train. I mean, it's that simple. You can throw the ball against the wall. It can rebound back to you. So we need a ball that can somewhat bounce, and you can do anywhere from 200 throws to 1,000. And 1,000 sounds like a lot of throws in a session, but it goes by pretty quick. And, I mean, again, you develop that work capacity over time, and 1,000 throws in a session is nothing. I mean, anybody can do that over a couple hard months of training. And, again, these throws are not like maximal, you know, intensity throws. We're not looking for maximal speed or distance on the ball. Doing real light throws against the wall. We're standing like 2 feet away from a wall or partner. I'm just throwing the ball back and forth real light, you know. So those are a lot of different ways. If you have a pool, that's another good one. You can hop in a pool and just do some real light swimming. Basically, again, as you can see the trend here, is just very low impact, low intensity movements. We're still trying to promote recovery. That's number one, and we're trying to promote work capacity development. So.
Absolutely. I thought that was important to touch on just in case people were not entirely sure, but that's it. You know, pretty much frame it what you're working towards. Something that this really sounds like to me is this sounds very heavily influenced by sort of track and field, which is just not something I think most people have been exposed to, or are they aware of sort of how good these methods are?
Right.
Is that something that you're sort of comfortable talking about for a minute?
Yeah.
Just because?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, I'd be lying if I said my training bias wasn't heavily geared from track and field. And it's, I mean, really, you look at it like speed development is, I mean, the purest form of speed development is running a straight line. And I know some coaches are not into, you know, training their athletes for linear speed development from point A to point B. And I do understand that sports, most team sports are not, I mean, if not all team sports require more of a multidirectional speed development, in most team sports, they're never going to hit top speed, right? And I totally agree with that. But at the same time, it doesn't hurt to develop acceleration. It doesn't hurt to develop max speed. That's not going to hurt any athlete, especially when they're going to be tested in the 40-yard dash. They're going to be tested in the 60-yard dash. Some point in their career, they're going to have to run in a straight line. You know, and I mean, even though that's not what team sports are, that could be the, that could be a deal breaker for a college scholarship. That can be a deal breaker for an NFL contract. It can be a deal breaker for an MLB contract. You know what I mean? So a lot of these sports are they're going to get tested in linear, you know, sprint tests. So it doesn't hurt to develop that quality. So that's why I kind of almost have a bias towards that. And they're getting – I mean, especially if they're practicing their sport a couple days a week in addition to training, I mean, they're getting enough – almost enough change of direction work as it is. So I think doing more of that is almost somewhat overkill, depending on the time of year, really. I mean, we still need to train maybe the younger kids on how to change direction quickly, properly, and even older kids, too. They could use it also. But I don't know. I mean, I just have found that – you know, you use these they're almost very simple techniques to get, you help these kids get faster. I mean, if it's helping these sprinters get extremely fast, why wouldn't it work for athletes? You know what I mean? And yes, the sprinters that are running 100 meters, I know it's, you know, somewhat of, it's not all straight speed. It's speed endurance and acceleration and, you know, relaxation techniques and all that, but that can still be applied to team sports. So, I don't know. I guess what I'm trying to say really is, like, it doesn't hurt to train that way, and I think more of us can benefit from training like a sprinter. And I mean, if you look at sprinters, and, you know, like, I use myself as an example. Like, I was a sprinter and a wide receiver in football, and you look at any sprinter, wide receiver, or any skill player, or, I mean, any football player, I mean, their physique is pretty good, really, and they're training, they're sprinting, they're not running long distances. Most likely some kids are, which I don't know why they're still jogging like miles and stuff for training. But I mean, most of them, they're sprinting, they're jumping, they're throwing, they're lifting weights. And then the really serious dedicated athletes are doing the low intensity recovery days, which also the good thing about those too, is it helps to kind of keep the body fat levels in check, you know, cause especially when we're trying to keep athletes, we're not trying to build bulky, fat, soft kids, right? We want lean, explosive, strong, fast kids. It doesn't do any good to have like a spare tire, like hanging on, you know, because I mean that 10 or 20 pounds extra body fat could be slowing you down a few tenths, you know, and you get rid of that right away and the kid gets faster, you know. So I think it's really good to train like an athlete regardless, and, you know, training for speed and strength, it doesn't hurt anybody regardless of your goal. So
It was very interesting to me, at least, because, you know, speed is something that I associate with track. I think the first time I ever saw dynamic flexibility, it was, you know, I think it was somewhere in the 80s. It could have been like the Olympics or something like that. But it just seemed sort of necessary and appropriate to sort of open people's eyes. One of the things you mentioned that I want to go back to for a second is sort of sled dragging and, you know, that's sort of expensive. It's not necessarily accessible. It snows in some places. Break down sort of how people can get into that if they're really interested.
Okay. I like that you mentioned that too, because, I mean, the sleds, quote, that I use at my gym aren't even real dragging sleds. It's an old car tire with a tow rope attached, and that's so simple to make. I mean, if I can make it, anybody can make it. I'm not, like, the most handy guy in the world. So, I mean, like, if I could do it, anybody could do it. And it's so simple. Like, all you need to do is go to, like, you know, like an old junkyard or, like, a tire yard. There's got to be one around most people somewhere. And, like, what I did, I just went to an old tire yard, and they had a scrapyard in the back of old tires that they just weren't using anymore. And I went up to the guy or one of the guys I was working on. I was like, hey, do you have any tires that you want to get rid of? Because most of the time they have to pay somebody to come out to come pick up old tires and get rid of them, taking them to dump. So they'll gladly give you two or three tires, like, no problem. And they're just old car tires or truck tires. And so I took them, and then all I did was take a drill, drill a hole through the side, screw an eye bolt through, put a nut and washer on the other side. And that's your sled right there. I mean, you have a hook. And all you need to do is get a carabiner and then a tow rope from, like, Home Depot. And a tow rope is, like, it's, like, a 20-foot long. It's made for towing cars, but they're super strong and sturdy. And the ones I have is just, like, nylon webbing, I think. and it's got like two little eyelets at the end, like for it's basically it's made for like for looping one end through the other, but those are perfect for like putting your hands on, so you have something to hold on to. And I mean, you don't have to use tow rope. You could use, I mean, really anything. You could use an old piece of rope if you have it. But the tow rope is easy. It costs like $20 at Home Depot. Just go to like the automotive section, and you can find it there. And then you just loop it through the eye bolt with a carabiner, and then that's your sled right there. I mean, that costs like maybe $20 to make. And most people can make that. And then as far as weighing it down, I just put a 45-pound plate on top of it. It fits perfectly. If you don't have plates, you can put rocks in the tire. You can put you can get creative, really. You can fill a duffel bag full of something. You can put a piece of plywood inside the tire so it doesn't fall through, and then put whatever you want in there, really, and then go out to a parking lot or a field and get to work.
Yeah, that's really important, because with a tire, you're going to get the friction, which you're not going to get necessarily from a sled. So if you have the ability to add weight to it, you know, then it's scalable, and then you're basically ready to go.
The friction, the friction aspect is what makes it, I think, a lot harder. I mean, when you drag it on the asphalt, and it's the more you weigh it down, the more friction you get. So it can get pretty challenging, even with just one 45-pound plate on an old tire.
So that's enough for people to work with if they're that
totally
dedicated
and
whatnot. You don't need to load people down unnecessarily. But I wanted to thank you for your time, but also give you a chance. Mentioned your gym very briefly in the beginning, but if people are interested in sort of finding you online or finding you in real life, how do they do it?
Yeah. So if you're an athlete, you know, I'm in Napa, California, which is Northern California, and in the San Francisco Bay Area. You can find me at ctsgym.com, and the name of the gym is CTS Training Conditioning. I also have a blog online that I try to update regularly, and that is Cortese, Cortese, Performance, PERFORMANCE.com, so CortesePerformance.com. And if you're not an athlete in Napa, you can, I'd love for you to stay in touch with me on my blog, sign up for the newsletter, and I'm giving away, three really good little mini ebooks in addition to this PDF, I think, that we'll give away too. And I think I have the blog linked in the PDF, so if people weren't able to catch that again, they can find that in the download. And if you guys have any questions, feel free to email me. I'm pretty good about writing back and my emails and stuff. So again, that's CortesePerformance.com and CTSGym.com.
Well, John, I appreciate the time. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Luke. Appreciate it.
All right, take care.
All right, bye.